Good morning, good morning. You have reached the higher ground with Stevie Wonder and yours truly flying live this morning in studio. This is Sister Carol, State Rep Ammons, whichever one you want to call. But I am here on higher ground flying solo. Brother A-Dub is about and traveling. And we're going to have a wonderful time together this morning. I know it's early, but that's okay. Early is good. Early is good. So we're going to talk this morning with a few very powerful women that are doing magnificent work in their own areas under their own right. So I just want you to know that you're going to enjoy your time with us this morning on Higher Ground. And you're welcome to join the conversation however you would like to. I take all questions, comments, disagreements. It doesn't matter to me. I'm willing to answer and maybe not answer, but you're welcome to call us at any point during this radio station's show at 217-359-5483. And if I miss your call, it's because I'm seriously multitasking this morning. I haven't run the board alone in over a year or so. So those out there, pray for me. This morning, you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And we are streaming live at WEFT.org. You can call me. You have to call me on the fly live number, though. Don't call the station because no one's here to answer it. So you can fly live by calling 217-359-5483. That's 217-359-5483. And you are welcome to call me at any point during the conversation. We will turn to you right away. We have a few things happening in this community this morning. I just want to let you know the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. These are all the views and opinions of the speakers and no one else. So don't get it twisted. We are not speaking for anyone but ourselves this morning. And we appreciate that. I don't represent anyone but Sister Carol. So don't say I'm representing the speaker, the state of Illinois, or anybody else other than me. So I'm very happy you hear laughter in the studio because I have a really long time friend in the studio with me, Mrs. Isak Griffith.
Hello, Sister Carol.
Good morning. And she's here with me because we're going to talk about some real serious stuff. And those things are, I think, relevant to you and your life and those who you love. And so you're welcome to join us as well. This morning, Isak and I go some distance back now. It's been some time since we met. I remember, if you don't mind, I'll just tell our little history right quick. Currently, Isak is the executive director of Courage Connection, formerly known as
Center for Women in Transition.
Most people know it that way.
A woman's place.
That's correct.
And the Transition Store at Lincoln Square Mall.
So it has a lot of lives and names.
Absolutely.
And has been a large contributor to this community. So we'll go back to that. I just want to give you a little bit of background as to who Isak is and how we came to know one another. Isak and I met when I was at the Independent Media Center. I was the program director for the AmeriCorps program that was run successfully for years at the Independent Media Center. And in year two, I was really, really looking for some really strong candidates to serve the community for a short period of time. And Isak was one of those persons that I met. And so I remember going and saying, hey, you should meet with me. She was not thinking about AmeriCorps. Didn't know what that was.
Oh, my gosh.
So I called her on the phone and said, would you meet me at the Courier, my favorite restaurant, just a little plug for the Courier. And she said, sure. And so we met at the Courier and we talked a little bit, had a lot in common. And I said, would you consider coming to work at the Independent Media Center with the AmeriCorps program just for a year? It's a short-term commitment. And, you know, we would really benefit from you being in the program at that time. And so she did. There were some good perks and benefits to doing that, which she went on and maximized those benefits at the University of Illinois and is a remarkable woman of inspiration, really. And a, I think, a business savvy guru, so to speak, and has a heart of compassion for the work that she does through Courage Connection. So I am so happy, Isaac, to have you in the studio this morning.
I now have an even bigger smile. I'd forgotten that I met you through the West African Drumming and Dance because we spent so much time at the Independent Media Center together. I've overwrote those memories. I forgot that we went back that far.
Yes.
And
because she was a drummer and I thought I was a dancer, so I don't know. That was true.
Yeah.
So we've really had, we shared art, culture, intellectual conversations, business,
spiritual service, conversation, family.
Just a plethora of things that
we've
gotten.
The birth of your first grandchild.
That's right. That we got together and we got to share and spend time together. So it is my pleasure to see you in the capacity that you're serving as the executive director of Courage Connections.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would kind of give us a professional background so that people will know what they're dealing with when they meet with you and see you and the work that you're doing.
Wow.
Say where to start.
Yeah. Especially with that kind of introduction. Prior military, and very thankful for that service. One of the best decisions that
and
I
you were in
made.
The Army, correct?
I was in the Air Force.
Air Force, okay.
And I spent 14 years in IT, primarily doing service, and ended up leaving that and having my own business for about 7 years doing executive coaching, life coaching. And
she's really good at that, y'all. Anyway, go ahead.
I still do it, but I reached a point where I realized I really wanted to be making a bigger impact, and I made the decision that I wanted to go back to school, but for me, getting a bachelor's was just painful. It took me 12 years. I worked nights, and it was just crazy. And so I swore I'd never go back to school. So when I made the decision, but it took me 5 years to really go from this is what I know I need to do to saying, okay, it's time to take action. And when I decided it was time to take action, I wanted to take a year of my life mostly to play.
Mm.
Mostly to play. Because going back to school, getting a master's in business is really quite a commitment. But I also know that it would change my life coming out on the other side. And I wanted a little bit of time to relax and to play and to think and to pray and make sure this is really the direction in which I needed to be going. And that's exactly when you sat down with me and said, hey, how about doing this for a year? And I thought, oh, my. And it was. I played. I had so much fun. I learned so much. I met incredible people. And it really gave me the time that I needed on the inside to prepare to completely turn my life into a direction. Taking everything I'd learned and having my own business and doing coaching and personnel development, getting the MBA here at Illinois. And I was actually recruited for the position at Courage Connection. I actually started 10 days after name change. So mm-hmm. I was part of the rebranding process and really stepping into this agency that has an incredible history here in the state of Illinois. It has the oldest battered women's shelter in the nation. It's run continuously since 1971. The transitional housing for women started in the 80s and has been in its current location since the 90s. And then the store opened up in Lincoln Square Mall 8 years ago. 6 years ago, 8 years ago, in part as a sort of creative revenue stream for the programs, but also as a way to give back to the community. And it's as a resale shop, the way we look at it is if we wouldn't buy it, we don't want it on the floor.
Mm.
Because it's so important to us that our clients are able to have things that when they go home, it feels like home and they can feel really proud of the home that they're going into. And so it provides really nice clothing and household goods as well as furniture for accessible prices. It's also an opportunity for job training for folks coming out of corrections or who happen to be our residents. And there's so much that we do from helping families figure out what they need to do to be safer in their day-to-day life to providing shelter and safety and counseling and help navigating the legal system. If you're one of our residents, you're also able to get clothes for you and your kids. When your kids keep growing and get to the next size, they get more clothes. It's amazing how expensive and how challenging life is. And if you're ready to rebuild your life and you have to start from ground zero, it's really important to know that there's there are people, one, who understand, but two, that there are resources to help you do so that you can be successful.
Yes, yes. I understand how, as a working mom and trying to help my last son get to where he wants to go mm-hmm. in his life, mm-hmm. He continues to grow. He's wearing a size 11 shoe just from last month.
Wow.
So it's really, you know, very costly for us today to mm-hmm. try to just basically take care of our families and give them a decent experience. Mm-hmm. And children, you know, they deserve to have something for themselves. And so the work that you all do at Courage Connections, I followed it through the years. I started off here when I came. I was recruited for the Woman's Place Board of Directors. And I served one term on that board before I went into the political realm. But it gave me a view of how society in some ways treat women mm-hmm. And not provide the necessarily the resources. So the facility struggled all the time.
Australia, I think, is doing something brilliant. If someone is a perpetrator of domestic violence, they get to go to a shelter.
Mm.
And the family gets to stay intact and in the home, but the person who's perpetuating the violence, the person who's perpetuating a crime, either goes to jail or is removed from the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a much more appropriate situation than someone who is the victim of a crime who now needs to find a way to have a place to live, to eat, to have a room over their own heads, provide shelter for their children, provide clothes and shoes and transportation, after school activities, affordable child care. Like, if you're already the victim of a crime, having to figure all of that out on your own just doesn't make any sense. And the fact that our society puts that on victims to figure out, I think is really shameful.
That's an interesting reverse.
I think it's brilliant because actually think it's more appropriate. If you are perpetrating a crime, if you're hurting people, if you're damaging lives, if you're risking the lives of the people that you say that you love, you should not be allowed to stay in that situation and continue to cause harm.
Right. But then put everybody else out. Right. Yeah.
Right. Going to hold a gun to your head and threaten to kill your children. And so I think you should leave in the middle of the night not knowing what to do to keep our children safe. I mean, that's just a crazy, crazy paradigm. And so I really love what Australia is doing. And I would love for our society to get on board with that. I think it's brilliant.
You find me some legislation and we'll work around it. I think the issue of domestic violence is a like you said, we don't respond to it the mm-hmm. way we're supposed to as a society, and women are treated as second-class citizens, and therefore they fight their way through the process as opposed to the perpetrator having to be upset in their lives. It's usually the victim and the children who are the sufferers of that.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that we haven't found a way to protect those two very vulnerable populations between women and children.
It really is about having a different kind of conversation. You know, if sort of, and this is an overgeneralization, you know, but if you hear a 12-year-old got knocked upside the head by his dad, most people would say, well, what did he do?
Mm-hmm,
right? As
true.
If there's, like it's okay and perfectly reasonable, you know, to beat a child. And we intellectually, we know that's not true, and yet we're still so conditioned to think that it's that there are cases where it's acceptable and appropriate to harm another being.
Mm.
And if it's okay to hurt children, then it's okay to hurt almost anyone.
Yeah, that's true.
And unfortunately, when you have a domestic violence situation, you have one partner who has been disenfranchised from family, from friends, possibly even from work, from their neighbors. And so they have fewer access to financial resources, to emotional resources, to basically any kind of resource. And so if that person realizes that maybe it really is time for me to go, they have so much less to lean on to start with when they walk out the door. But the person who's in control of the finance, in control of the home, in control of the vehicles, in control of every aspect of their lives, they have all the resources they need and more.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a disparity set up just from that domestic violence relationship where one person really is in control. And we react as if the victim somehow really is in control.
Mm.
And the victim isn't. The victim is never in control.
That's an interesting, and I've seen it play out, of mm-hmm. course, over and over. I remember touring a woman's place right after you became the executive director.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the changes that were mm-hmm. taking place to really make the center more accessible and mm-hmm. family friendly mm-hmm. and, you know, help those children and put in a playground and all of these things to make their lives a little more stable. But we never systemically address the displacement mm-hmm. of the mother and the mm-hmm. children. And I think that's something that we can continue to push for and try to fix. It's been difficult for you, though, since taking over now Courage Connections. And it's not necessarily because you are not providing stability for the center, but that we're in a quagmire in the state that is affecting your ability to work. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Before you do that, there's something I would like to clarify. When we talk about domestic violence in general, we sort of the cultural language around domestic violence is men abusing women. And that's a narrow view. Really, anyone can become a victim of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And we see it in all kinds of relationships. We see it in same-sex relationships, in relationships where no one's married. Domestic violence is also can be perpetrated against your parent, against mm-hmm. your child, against your niece, your nephew, your aunt, your uncle. Domestic violence, or even your roommate.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
that's somebody who has, you know, shares that. And so domestic violence is a much bigger picture. And I think that's really important, and we tend to forget that. In terms of,
I think it's portrayal, it's media, it's television.
Well,
right.
It yes and no. Part of it is most cases of domestic violence are in fact
male versus female,
men abusing women.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really important to be really clear that just because that's what we see more often, it's not exclusive, because when somebody who doesn't fit that profile is a victim, I need for them to know that they can come to us.
Okay.
And I think that's really important. But yeah, things are kind of crazy. The state of Illinois budget, sorry, complete shift of gears. It's impacting so many people in our community in so many levels, as well as our agency. It's hard.
So have you all had to reduce the number of people that you're serving at this point?
Not yet, although changes are going to be coming here in the next few weeks, and will continue to change. The way that grant funding works for agencies is a specific grant funds either a specific program or a specific position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we do have a couple of positions that are not being fully funded right now because of the state. But the big concern for us is that we have almost $400,000 tied up in the state budget.
Mm, okay.
And tell me any small business that can operate if $400,000 of their revenue just doesn't get in the door. The frightening thing is most of that specifically goes to support the operation of the domestic violence shelter itself.
Mm.
So it's not as if I can reduce staff to cover those costs because I have grants
the shelter
paying
itself.
For those staff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if I lay off those staff, I have to give that money back.
Okay.
So what is actually at risk right now is the survival of the domestic violence shelter, because how do we reach out to the community and say, can you help us, you know, come up with $400,000 a year? That's not reasonable. But mm-hmm. that's exactly part of why we pay taxes, is that when there is a community need, we share in that burden with our taxes, so that the impact of that burden doesn't have a stronger impact on a day-to-day basis to that community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that system right now is incredibly broken, which means not only are we paying our taxes, our community is going to be more and more burdened because of the cuts throughout the community. You know, imagine a woman who comes to us because her husband kills the dog and threatens to kill the children. So she comes to us not knowing where else to go. She hasn't worked in several years because of the situation, because of the dynamics, domestic violence. So she's able to find affordable job or child care. She's able to get a job. She finds an apartment. She signs a lease for a year. And then earlier this year, they change access to affordable child care. She lost her child care. She missed a few days of work because all of a sudden she didn't
know where to go.
Didn't have anywhere. The resources mm-hmm. to provide for her children, so she lost her job, which means she lost her apartment. So because of state funding, we now have someone in our community who is homeless with children, who had a job, who was getting on her feet, who was able to provide the needs for her children, but is now, again, homeless. It's a bigger burden on the community. And because she had a year lease, she has to pay the remaining 10 months on that lease before she's eligible to get housing anywhere else.
We are here on WEFT 90.1. I'll put a pin in that because that is a moment where you have to gasp. 90 WEFT, this is Sister Carol Emmons in On Higher Ground. Brother A-Dub is away. We want you to call us this morning. Feel free to do so at 217-359-4483. That's 217-359-5483. I'm speaking with Isa Griffith with the Courage Connection. She's the executive director of the agency. And we're talking about the real life impact of what is happening at the state level. Not the numbers, not the advertising and the sound bites, but what's happening in the lives of individuals. I want you to know that this hour program brought to us by Kevin Elliott Counseling with a diverse group of 30 licensed therapists providing individual group and family, group family and marital therapy. Kevin Elliott Counseling is located at 309 West Clark Street near downtown Champaign. For more information, you can call them and feel free to do that at 217-398-906. Or you can see Kevin Elliott, ELLIOTT, counseling.com. That's Kevin Elliott, counseling.com. We'll announce that again. I know people are struggling in their day-to-day lives and really need someone to talk to. Mm-hmm. You can certainly reach out to Kevin Elliott Counseling and ESOC at Courage Connection to at least get someone to help you see your way through. So people we know are losing their very foundation.
Losing everything. And our lives are so interconnected. And the resources that we use in our lives are so interconnected that when we lose access to one, it creates this incredible and almost immediate snowball effect.
Yeah.
And, you know, people think, well, that sounds dire. Well, take a look at what happened in the nation in 2008. You know, a handful of people made some horrible, horrible decisions.
Yeah.
And it destroyed our economy. And it impacted the economy of the entire world. And and we understand it when it's on that sort of global financial scale. But that pattern is consistent throughout all of life.
So let's talk about childcare for a minute.
Yeah.
Let me just clarify for the listeners. I know that you've watched television and they continue to tell you that the Speaker of the House and the Democrats are holding the budget impasse and not being reasonable. But let's talk about what we're standing against for a minute. The decision to change the eligibility on child care was not a legislative decision.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't come to the floor of the House and we voted yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
That was an administrative decision strictly tied to the governor's office and his administration. He decided that changing the eligibility, because in their view, you got to eliminate fraud. This is the media soundbite.
Mm-hmm.
There's fraud rampant in the system, and we need to eliminate fraud. Where there's fraud, we saw that in 2008. That's really what fraud looks like. What we're experiencing in the state of Illinois is a draconian measure that is leading to what you just described in this young lady's story, because she's only one. I receive mm-hmm. a report each month, and we're turning down, if we have 180 applicants for childcare today, 170 of them will be turned down
mm-hmm.
as ineligible. Now, they would have been eligible prior to the administrative change, but from that point, they have become ineligible. We're talking about people who make minimum wage.
Well, and it's so funny because people think, you know, people with children, take a look at two-parent households. Mm-hmm. How many of those two-parent households make the decision for one parent to stay at home with the child because child care costs more than that person could bring in?
That's right.
But what do you do when there's one income and child care can now cost more than what that one parent can make? What choices, what viable choices are out there?
And there hasn't been a response, although we've made, and when I say we, meaning there was legislation put forward in the Senate and the House to reverse the change mm-hmm. on the eligibility. We weren't able to do that mm-hmm. because we didn't have the requisite votes mm-hmm. to make that change. But the continued attempt from the Democratic side of the House, because this is strictly being done by Democrats at this point, by the Democratic side of the House and the Senate to reverse these changes has been unsuccessful.
Well, the whole process from the word go, there's so much wrong with it. I mean, the fact that Illinois is legally making payments to everyone except the people who have the smallest voices is, to me, just horrifying. Because part of what that does is it removes pressure.
Yes.
And it removes a desire to actually deal with the issue, except for the people who are impacted on a day-to-day basis, but no one's listening. Well, there are people listening, but it's hard for those voices to get into the ears of people who are actually in a position to make make a difference.
Right.
And I think it's important to recognize that what's happening is unprecedented.
This is unprecedented.
It is absolutely.
Yes.
WCIA asked me a couple weeks ago, well, why didn't we hear how desperate it was several months ago? Well, several months ago, it didn't feel desperate because Illinois has this pattern of coming down to the wire and then
and
we get it in there
it.
And then everything's mm-hmm. going to be fine. We're all going to lose a little bit of money together and agree that we're all going to lose a little bit of money, right? That's the pattern. No one believed for a moment that we would be at the end of October and not even talking about the budget anymore.
Yeah.
Like, and then here in weeks we have elections.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, you know, our freshmen representatives getting their feet on the ground. So even if we have a conversation about the budget in November or December, nothing's going to happen but further to the year when you're supposed to start talking about the new budget.
Yes.
and so the fact that we're in this position, I think, was beyond the capacity for any of us to honestly imagine.
I sat on the floor and could not imagine that there was no way to get a single Republican who had voted in favor of child care many years and many budgets before to vote against child care. I'd never imagined that that would be a reality. I never imagined that in order to get a budget passed for the state, and we've done many budgets at the city and the county level, and we may not have agreed, but we got to have a budget, and so we do it. I never imagined that we would get to the fall and not be able to describe whether we were in veto session, spring session, summer. What is this?
Yeah.
Been able to figure this out.
And
right?
For me, it's stunning. I'm an executive director. My job is fiscal responsibility. If I showed up at my board meeting 4 months into my fiscal year and said, well, I still just can't figure it out, I would not have a job.
It would seem pretty clear.
Right? I have a budget deficit pending of $400,000. It's my responsibility to go to the board and say, this is how we're going to do this. If I went to my board and said, I can't do anything because you're not helping me, like that's just crazy because it's my job. And I would love for the state to hold the governors accountable as I would be held in my position.
Let me tell you that someone's calling us in the studio, and you're welcome to call, but you must call me at 217-359-5483. If you want to call me, this is Cheryl here at Higher Ground, you must call me at 217-359-5483, and I'll be glad to take your call. Again, 217-359-5483. 8-3. I am watching the board and it should light up if you call me. So I will answer the phone. That is my intention. So we are talking about the impact and you're calling me. So that's a good sign. I'm going to turn this on. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. You should be on the air because I've pushed the button.
Hello.
Can I hear you?
Hello, caller.
It is green, and you're green. Oh, it's still ringing. I can hear it. Good morning, caller. Are you there? All right. I got both lines open, and neither one. I can hear neither one.
No.
That's not cool. Okay. All right. So just hold on, you guys, because I'm going to try and figure this out and see why I can't hear you. I should be able to. Let's see. Hello?
Ooh. Hello, can you hear us now?
Oh, I got you. Wow. Hold on 1 second, okay?
All right.
All right. Hold on. Second caller, you there?
Carol?
Hi.
Interestingly, you have two callers on the line. This is Sandra. I'll just wait while you're talking to your first caller.
Okay, you hold 1 second. Okay, who is the second caller? Who's the first caller?
This is Chris, Carol.
Oh, hey, Chris. I'm good. I finally got both of y'all. Okay, go ahead, Chris. You go first, and then I'll put Sandra on.
Okay. Well, thank you for the very intelligent and necessary conversation this morning. I just wanted to chime in with the bigger picture that in this county, we average since 1998 over 3,500 domestic battery offenses per year, 3,500 a year. So this is a very widespread problem. And I guess I want to, Carol, you can chime in about this better than anybody, is that, you know, the will, the political will to take care of the most vulnerable just isn't there. That, in fact, there is plenty of money in the city and county budget to make sure our shelter is taken care of and our emergency services are taken care of so that families don't have to live on the street. And I just, maybe Carol, you could chime in on the possibility that local budgets could make budgetary way to make sure the shelters are funded. And I'll hang up and let Sandra have her turn.
I truly appreciate you. Thank you so much, Chris. And I will chime in on that.
Oh, go ahead.
Sandra,
I can wait.
Tell me which number you called.
We both called 359-94, or your Fly Live number.
Okay, let me
but
turn off
the 6.
But
at first, we didn't hear anything ringing. You couldn't hear us. And then, anyway, then we both got connected.
I got it.
But you're here now.
Yes, we are.
So one of the things that I'll say, I believe, as Chris believes, that when we get into a crisis like this, the cities, both cities, and the county should always come together and save those institutions that are critical to the community, like Center for Women in Transition, Courage Connection, like we experienced when I was on a county board with Prairie Center, mm-hmm. and the state of Illinois was going through a similar crisis at that time and not funding drug treatment programs like Prairie Center. And I was advocating at that time that the county should fund the Prairie Center, because I believe that those are critical services for the community in order to keep a simple process of support in place. And that didn't happen at the county level, because some people don't believe, as Chris said, that that is the responsibility of the county to fund these agencies. And in the case of Courage Connection and the potential of losing our shelter, that is the only shelter here.
It's the only shelter in four counties.
So if we think about that, we know we have a real investment that we need to make to save those institutions that provide, again, the basic structure for families in crises.
And Carol, I think Chris said something really important to not gloss over, that this is a political will.
Mm.
Can you talk about what that means?
Well, as my experience on the county board and my experience in the city council taught me that if you don't have people who understand fundamentally the importance of providing, i.e. shelter services in your community, they don't have any desire, mm-hmm. no desire to serve those people. And so they don't see the expediency of making sure that there's reserve money in the time of crises for our community organizations that serve, again, those four counties like Courage Connection. And so they don't have that political will.
So what creates political will?
Pressure from the public,
okay.
and electing people who understand at the heart the importance of policies that impact the lives of people, as well as understanding the value of organizations like Courage Connection mm-hmm. in your community. And so people must understand beyond the holidays of giving. You know, I'm sorry, Sandra.
No, it's okay.
We are coming
okay.
back, we promise.
I'm totally listening.
But the whole, you know, give them a turkey and send them on their way kind of philosophy, mm-hmm. I've never ascribed to that. And so I believe in getting in and driving in a way that says we need to save this agency.
Well, I think there's value in that, right? I think there's value in doing something that helps you feel better about yourself. I just think it needs to go deeper.
I need a little deepness here.
Yes.
Sandra, go ahead.
Yes, please.
I'm sorry.
No, it's quite all right. Well, a lot of good things to think about this morning that you talked about. Thank you, Isak, for being on, and Carol for being here.
Thank
and
you.
Weft for being on the YouTube.
Yes.
They are this important conversation. One of the things, Isak, that you said early on was about how it's done differently in Australia. And I think one of the things that we forget unless we hear this conversation like you're having is that this is a way that society views things. It's mm-hmm. not the way things absolutely are.
Yes.
In other words, you know, that how we treat people, how we treat children, the child care, just as an example, that we could just plain out fund child care and it would be a completely normal and acceptable and thing mm-hmm. to do, just like we fund Medicare. It becomes part of our system, and that's yeah. just what we do. And we start believing and understanding the value of it as we do it. And so it's
and the cost saving of actually doing that.
What's that?
And the cost saving of providing
yes.
really good child care and early childhood
exactly.
education.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it's so hard, you know, when you talk about, Carol, how you did, you know, that people just can, well, anyway, that just put it in a different ballpark as if it's not necessary and it should be just our basic foundation.
Yeah.
But I wanted to just speak to the fact that the state of Illinois budget again, just to think about that, because the perspective is better than the other, but I just want to say, like, it's affecting everybody.
Yes.
Our counseling business, who underwrites the program, is in the state owes us over $30,000, and we're a small business,
mm-hmm.
and so it's not just affecting not-for-profits, it's affecting small businesses, too,
mm-hmm.
and will result in, you know, we just keep absorbing it because we've just lived with this pattern with the
right.
state. We accept HealthLink insurance, even though a lot of people don't, because HealthLink is state funded. But it's an election that the University of Illinois employees have as to use HealthLink, and some of them do.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're not paying Health Alliance's premiums either. The
right.
other choice, they're not paying those premiums. So at any moment, Health Alliance could stop paying.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did, we would probably, I don't know what would happen to our business and many other businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So
I
just wanted to bring that point of view in too. And hopefully because we're taking, I'm sorry that we have to say that because it's affecting small businesses now, that's more important than affecting the shelters, et cetera. But at least maybe it will help. People have to get involved and say that it's unacceptable.
Well, I think there's something, it's really easy to relate to something that you do relate to already.
Mm-hmm.
And although there are homeless all over, there are victims. I mean, 35 domestic batteries a year?
3,500.
I'm sorry, 3,500 a year
mm-hmm.
is staggering.
It is.
But if it's not in your personal life, it's easy to believe or at least it's easy to act like it's not really there.
Mm-hmm.
As the budget starts to impact people who are slowly higher and higher on that socioeconomic ladder, people are going to pay more attention because now it's close to home.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I agree. Unfortunately, it has to get to that point, but it is going to get to that point. As
yeah,
we're,
it definitely
we're,
is.
Our healthcare is going to be impacted. We're going to, and it's really easy to say, well, we're going to have more people who are homeless living on the street. But what's going to be the impact of kids who don't have a safe place to go? What's going
mm-hmm.
to be the impact of teens who are coming from really challenged backgrounds who don't have a place to be in the afternoon or a viable way to make money? What's going to happen when the whole has to cut down on staff because they're no longer getting the state funds?
Right.
What's going
right.
to be the impact on the yeah. emergency room? What's going to be the impact on your health care when your surgeon no longer has a job?
Right. And just a quick little story. I know a U of I employee who has a daughter in Ball State University in Indiana who tore her something on her knee and needed to have physical therapy and couldn't get it because HealthLink did not pay her bill with a physical therapist. And so now she can't get her physical therapy on her knee because nobody will, you know, they won't accept it. So it's at every level now, is what I'm saying. So, people wake up. We all need to wake up and figure out what we can do. Carol, can you give us some advice about how to apply that pressure?
Well, and wake up before it impacts you on a personal level.
Yeah.
I think applying that pressure really needs, I get calls, Sandra, in the office every week. And the calls go something like this. We want our legislators to get in a room and lock themselves in and work this thing out with the governor. And I say to them, and I say, well, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to go every day and I'm willing to stay in the room until we work it out. But I'm going to tell you what won't come out of that room. The governor has sent us numerous communications saying, in order for us to have this budget, in order for you to save these agencies that you so love, you're going to have to give me my turnaround agenda. And what is that? The turnaround agenda says we want to eliminate the unions. Uh-huh. We want right to work to exist in the state of Illinois, and they want to do it legislatively, and he's using the budget as the leverage point.
Yeah.
And so if people ask me, do you want me to stay in the room and give him that? You know, let me know. I don't believe that's the case.
Right.
But the reality is what he's asking for is nearly impossible to get 71 Democrats to support.
Well, and there's something interesting about saying, I want you to make constitutional changes to the state of Illinois before we talk about who we want to make sure doesn't end up homeless on the street.
So the pressure needs to go to him. Mm-hmm. As in reality, as the person who's making this demand,
mm-hmm.
he's saying in order for you to get the needed services that the state should provide by constitutional instruction as legislators and governor, in order for you to even get that acted upon, you must give me a historic change in tort reform, workers' compensation, right to work, you know, eliminating agencies that he completely eliminated out of the budget altogether. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what he's asking us for.
And what is our recourse with regard to recalling? Is there any, I mean, I know there's a little movement toward it. Is it legislatively possible?
So one aspect, and I did speak to a senior member about this because I had gotten calls on it. One aspect of the conversation is that in our recall rules in Illinois, you have to have a certain amount of Democrats and Republicans signed on to recall, right? Well, that's going to be real tough because right now we have no Republicans willing to vote for child care. Mm-hmm. So the recall mm-hmm. is not happening. There's another angle that says, according to the constitutional authority and responsibility of a governor, he is not fulfilling those duties according to the Constitution. And, you know, there are different mindsets as to whether you can impeach a governor according to the Constitution's impeachment rules, mm-hmm. impeach a governor based on his withholding of a budget, right? But the impact of that has to rise, in my opinion, to mm-hmm. a fever pitch you saw in Wisconsin where people said, that's, you know, this is absolutely asinine for us to be experiencing this and putting it on the people of Illinois and no one's responding through legislative means. So the people must rise up and put that pressure on the legislature to force him to act, i.e., using impeachment powers, or two, for the people to call for his impeachment.
So we have a situation where at least 15 domestic violence shelters alone in the state are about to shut down. And once they close down, they probably will never reopen.
That's true.
75% of all social service agencies in the southern part of the state have had to let go of people and services.
Yeah.
It's statewide, lives are being impacted, mm-hmm. and yet we still have, for the most part, I think, a constituency that isn't overtly politically engaged. I mean, mm-hmm. this is now costing real lives.
Yeah. I mean, we lost the Department of Natural Resources, right? So
when you can shut down the state library.
You can shut down the library. and to me,
that's a really great symbol of all the things that are wrong on all kinds of levels.
Yes.
But what's it going to take to get that kind of public outcry when we have a state full of people who think Illinois politics are sort of the brunt of the political jokes of the nation? You know, mm-hmm. What does it take?
Yes, yes. Well, I think that people need to, again, force the response of the legislature, the leadership, forcing them, meaning their presence. Last week when we were there, Sandra, it was amazing. Let me just tell you this. It made people uncomfortable.
Good.
And I thought it was great.
Good.
So we had 80 students from the U of I and students from all over the state of Illinois converge onto the Capitol. And they weren't quiet. See, they weren't quiet. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know how to respond to this because they were saying, wait a minute, they're disrupting our non-meeting because we weren't passing legislation.
Right.
So what the hell was we? They're disrupting our non-meeting right now. And the only thing they could do was clear the chamber.
Yeah.
You know, that was, but the students remained the entire day saying, as long as you're here, we're going to be here and we're going to make it uncomfortable for you to continue to ignore the fact that we've lost almost all our daycare centers. And
how do we get more people
to care
at that level?
We have to send our messages through our communities. The media, the main is not telling the story. Right. We need the independent media to step up. And I've been talking to the independent media saying, you all need to write this stuff and publish it.
Mm-hmm.
People must know through all circuits that this is not business as usual. This is not just a difference between a governor and a state legislature.
No, it's bigger than that.
This is bigger than that. This is very much a historic change.
And thank you for saying that.
That will forever change what happens to people in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have to take it that seriously
mm-hmm.
when they begin to say, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
I can write, I can email, I can come when I'm available to come to Springfield. Mm-hmm. I can organize people who are not working and say, you guys need to contribute your bodies to this fight. We have to get to that fever pitch that mm-hmm. we saw in Wisconsin and stop this madness by pushing our legislation and make it uncomfortable.
That's
what we must do.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sandra. I'm going to let you off this line, honey. I appreciate you listening and calling.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You've said something I've yet heard anyone articulate, and I think that's a message that really needs to get out loudly and clearly. This is not just two men fighting for power.
Mm-mm.
The problem is the political climate in the state of Illinois and the political apathy that tolerates that as an acceptable situation.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's not been forced to end means that really, to some degree, it is treated as an acceptable situation. And that's the horror. Like, and it's only going to change when the entire state rises up and says it has to change.
I sat there and I said, you mean we can't get one person to say Meals on Wheels should be funded?
Yeah.
On the other side of the aisle, and no one's pressuring their Republican legislators and saying, wait a minute.
Yeah.
There are people in their districts that are impacted just like my district, but they're not responding. And so there needs to be a real sense of, you know what, guy, whoever you are, you're not going to exist in this space if you're just going to kowtail mm-hmm. to this governor. And that is what is taking place right now. And the media is not going to say that. They say, oh, Carol is critical of the governor. Mm-hmm. She's being unfair. Really? Well, let's look at what's happening. Whatever the speaker may have done before that we all hate it. I was one of those organizers. whatever he may have done before might not have been good. But what he is doing today with his leadership is saying we're not going to give in to a governor who's going to diminish and demolish everything mm-hmm. that we actually stand for in a democratic society
mm-hmm.
by rolling us back to a lower wage system, right? Eliminating social service needs, cutting child care to where it doesn't exist
mm-hmm.
in the state of Illinois. Turning away 8% of our federal funds. Something is wrong with this picture. So we're going to continue to fight for Courage Connections.
Thank you.
For Kevin Elliott Counseling, for small businesses in our community. We have to continue to fight for these things. Otherwise, Illinois as we know it won't exist anymore.
Mm-mm.
And I appreciate you spending the first hour with me talking about
Thank you so much. And I think we're closer to that than people realize. We are in it when we socially and economically abandon widows and children. And systemically, that's okay. We have really big problems, and that we have to come together to find a solution so that everybody benefits.
I think it is critical. It's at a critical fever pitch. And I'm going to continue this conversation in the second hour with a former state rep who's here with us this morning. She's running for comptroller, and there's some comptroller conversations that are tied directly into this budget that people may not realize, but we are going to excavate them this morning so people have a broader view. This radio station and all other independent media sources are critical to getting us to fever pitch. And we hope that people who are listening to the sound of my voice this morning will say, what will it take for me to get involved at a higher level? And I hope you're considering that this morning. I'm going to switch and transfer us with a great song by Barb Marley.
Thank you for your courage and conviction to say the things that we need to hear.
You know, I figure if I'm going to be here, I may as well go and represent the true feelings of the people we know are really struggling, community, small businesses who are not making it. Nonprofit agencies and business owners who provide childcare who have closed the doors. That's the least I can do is tell
thank
a story.
You.
So thank you so much, Isak Griffith from Courage Connections. And you all stay tuned. We're going to listen to Bob Marley and hopefully get inspired to get involved. And this is Higher Ground 90.1. My closet, my minx, my socks and drawers, my charms, my links. All right. We're not going to fool the people all the time. We're going to get up and stand up for our rights. Boy, this has been a wonderful morning with my wonderful friend, Isak Griffith. And I really appreciate her over at Courage Connection, not with an S. joining me this morning and really starting the conversation off that we're going to share this with Susana Mendoza, candidate for comptroller for the state of Illinois. And most people may not even realize what that is, but we will make them clear this morning. And I know you're trying to call me so-and-so somebody that I'm going to answer the phone next time you call me. You can call me 359-5483. Now, I tell you what, it's not ringing right now inside the studio, but I am going to keep my eye out on the little green button. And I tried to turn on the ringer so I can hear you. Oh my God, it works. Oh my God, let's do this and see if I can answer it, though. Interesting. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. Turn your radio down, please. Turn your radio down, and maybe you can hear me and I can hear you.
Yes, ma'am, Ms. Representative Ammons. I am listening online, and there's a delay. So I was listening as you were introducing our next comptroller. But I've been listening all morning, and I wanted to make sure I did give an underwriting shout-out to Kevin Elliott Counseling. And I appreciate you being in there on Higher Ground on my show.
Oh, is this your show? Well, I appreciate you listening this morning, and we have really been informed and certainly inspired by our callers as well as our guests in studio this morning. And we're going to continue that energy and spirit and hopefully make a very clear request to the listeners so that they will see the importance of what we're doing, not only electorally, but what we're doing socially, spiritually, to improve the lives of the people of the state of Illinois. So I want you to continue to listen. If you have questions for our next guest, Susana Mendoza, I do want you to feel free to call back. I'll take the next caller, and I will hear from you soon. Thank you.
Wow, I don't get to say no question or nothing?
Well, hold the line, please. Thank you. Good morning. You're on WFT.
Yes, good morning. Before you get on with your next guest, I just wanted to make a comment.
Sure, go ahead.
Browner and his ilk, the Republicans, are acting exactly like that abusive man in the House who is beating everybody else up and then forcing the family and the children out into the street. It's just the similarity is so obvious, but I think people are missing that. So thank you so much for your first guest and you for being there. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you calling. I definitely will make sure that people know that you're suggesting that there's a connection between the leadership of a certain person in the southern part of the United States who's doing some disheartening things. And we know that what we're experiencing certainly has a historic framework, and we'll continue to highlight that. I appreciate your call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Go ahead, first caller. You're on the line. It's too loud? All right. You want to share with our guests?
Well, I wanted to just first say that in response to radical and unreasonable proposals, there should be radical responses to those unreasonable proposals. And so what we've been saying all along is that you have to get up and stand up and fight for your rights. You can't sit back quietly and expect that your silence will hopefully resonate, or there'll be some moral seizure by this individual and the folks he's controlling now with his $20 million. So the people are indeed going to have to do some things way outside of their comfort zones if they want to show that this is not going to be business as usual. You're not dealing with an individual who cares about people. So he doesn't care about all of these comments and this concern about, you know, losing child care or anything like that. He doesn't care about that. Mm-hmm. He treats his employee that way. He's manipulated hedge funds and manipulated nursing homes and stuff. He doesn't care about people. So trying to use that approach is a waste of time, breath, and energy. He's going to understand one thing: power of the people, meeting the power of the dollar. That's what he's going to understand, and that's the only thing he's going to respond to. So people are going to have to leave their homes. They're going to have to take days off if they can, or if they're not working, just go camp out in the Capitol, and you say you ain't leaving until there's a budget. Period. And you're going to have to take all these citizens in Illinois to jail and fill up the jails around Springfield, because we are not going to sit back and let you represent. You're not going to represent us in this particular fashion. That's what it's going to take. And so when the fever pitch that you're talking about, it's going to have to get there in order for that to be really recognized. What the students did was good. That was good. But they went home, mm-hmm, and they back, mm-hmm, in class. Mm-hmm. No, you're going to have to stay there and say, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to work. I'm not doing anything until you all get this budget stuff squared away, until the governor comes off this unreasonable, ridiculous approach to think you're going to hold all of us hostage. We ain't going to allow that to happen. That's what has to happen.
Well, I appreciate you. I hope someone's listening, and that is what it's going to take. You know, it really will take that fever pitch. You keep listening, and I'll introduce our next guest to continue the conversation. Thank you.
It's my show.
It's your show. Bye-bye. That was Brother A-Dub, who's normally flying in this seat that I'm sitting in. I'm sitting in on our high ground show. So thank you so much, WEFT. And thank you to Brother Aaron, who's, again, out fighting for our rights. He's traveling to Iowa today for the presidential dinner with Hillary and Bernie Sanders. And so we're going to continue to fight to fever pitch. At this point, I'd like to introduce our next comptroller, as he described her, Susana Mendoza, to WEFT listeners. So you can say good morning to
them. Good morning. So excited to be here.
And she is here with us all weekend, and she's going to be traveling about East Central Illinois. So she's going to go meet some friendly face here while she's here. And she is running for comptroller, but she wasn't always that. She's currently in office in Chicago, mm-hmm, and you could talk about that. And she was also a former state rep, so I have to take advantage of asking her some questions about that, and maybe she has some solutions that we can take into account for this current budget crisis. And they're calling it an impasse. It's important that we use correct language, because this is not an impasse. We're not like just kind of sitting by each other and not able to move. We're in a budget crisis because, mm-hmm, the non-movement has resulted in people losing their jobs, their lives, their houses. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, students who will not be able to go to college because we can't pay our MAP grants. And we, the list is long. So sure. It's a budget crisis, and I hope people will begin to talk about it that way. But Susanna's here to talk about how she wants to change what we see happening out of the current comptroller's office, mm-hmm, and bring another level of leadership to the state. Susanna, introduce yourself.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much, Carol. And hello to all of the listeners. Excited to be here. Last night I was out in Coles County for a meet and greet with some folks, and that was wonderful. Oh. I got a little bit of sparring in with someone who was talking about the Dems versus the Repubs, mm, and that it's not all the governor's fault. And
sure is not.
It was great practice for me, so it was awesome. And in any event, you mentioned that I was in the state legislature, and that's true. I got elected to the state legislature when I was 27. Mm. I was the youngest member at that time in the chamber, or actually in any elected office at that time, back in 2001. Now we see youngsters all the time. It's pretty, mm-hmm, exciting. Mm-hmm. But in any event, I got elected to 6 terms in the Illinois General Assembly. And I left in 2011 when I was sworn in as Chicago's city clerk.
Okay.
Now, that's the second largest office in the city. It's the most visited office related to city government. And we've done some really amazing things in that executive management position. So I feel more than ready and prepared to work for this position, which is also an executive management position. But it does so much more, the comptroller's office, than just deal with spreadsheets and numbers and, you know, figures. It's really about prioritizing not just the fiscal health of the state, but I would say even just as importantly, if not more, the moral health, mm-hmm, of the state. And that's really what we're seeing now, is that your comptroller has to be taken to court to release payments for early intervention service providers, for the developmentally disabled and our seniors who can't even go to the restroom or bathe or clothe themselves,
right,
feed themselves, right? I mean, it's really insane that we've gotten to a point in this state where you have to wait to be sued or else be held in contempt of court if you don't release payments. And certainly our comptroller isn't helping things when she says that She's proud to be the governor's wingman. It's not me saying that. That's what she said in front of a whole big, huge crowd of Republicans on Governor's Day. And you think, oh, my Lord, how could you go to sleep at night being proud to be the governor's wingman on a budget that is decimating families across the state of Illinois? So very excited about the opportunity to get to travel the entire state to let people know who I am, what I'm about. You know, I'm the daughter of a union pipe fitter. I'm the daughter-in-law of a electrician, a union electrician, who raised 9 kids on his ability to provide for family through a good working job and a good paying job. I'm the sister of a police officer who's also part of a labor union. And I know the sacrifices that the labor movement has made for all of us, because even though I'm not in a union myself, I certainly have benefited from the many struggles that came before even my dad having been able to join a union. And the reality of it is that this, what the governor wants to do, eradicating, not hurting labor or negotiating that, right? But like eliminating them from the face of the planet,
right,
is not just going to hurt labor. It's going to hurt every single person who has a job, because this is really about driving down wages, not just for the labor movement, but for everyone. And so people really need to wake up to that, that this is a fight that's going to affect every single one of us. And I will do my part to lead the charge on pushing back and fighting against that. And while your listeners can't really see me, they may not know what I look like. I'm not some towering force, you know. I know you guys have Mike Frericks here, who's about 20 feet tall. I'm the complete opposite. I'm more like 5'3", but I'll tell you what, I'm little, but I'm spicy. And I'm looking to, you know, throw a little pepper that way, because this is not a fight that's just going to be taken on by, you know, trying to talk it out. The governor has no interest in that. He has talked about the fact that social services and inflicting pain on social service providers and their recipients is an opportunity for leverage to get things done and change.
And he actually said that. Yes, he did.
He said that. So please don't think that that's what I think. I'm telling you what actually said. It's alarming. And he said that before he ran, and he said it since then. And to think that he believes that inflicting, as he calls it, temporary pain for long-term gain on people is actually helpful. It's crazy to me, because he has never for a day in his life known what it's like to feel 1 hour's worth of pain. The guy makes about $27,000 an hour just for breathing. And you're going to tell a mom who makes $10,000 a year that she doesn't deserve a helping hand, not a handout, but a helping hand in sending her child to daycare. I mean, really, it's not criminal, but it should be.
Well, we are going to talk about why it should be criminal, and maybe we'll pass a law to make it criminal in the state of Illinois. You can join us in this conversation by calling 217-359-5483. That's 217-359-5483. We certainly want to hear from you, answer any questions you may have for Susana Mendoza, who's running for comptroller, or myself. We're happy to answer your questions, and you don't have to agree with us, but we will certainly represent our positions. In this case, we know by the voice of the governor that his intention is to inflict pain.
That's right.
So that he says we will make Illinois a more business-friendly community. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that looks like, and maybe somebody out there can tell me what that looks like. Can we talk about legislatively? Because when you were in the legislature, if you wanted to change workers' compensation, and I think you guys did, you all put forth a bill, you negotiated that bill, and tell us how that worked.
It's called democracy.
How does that actually work? I mean, either he doesn't get it or I don't get it, but somehow there's a process that's supposed to take place here that's not taking place.
Yeah, we just go back to Schoolhouse Rock.
Let's start over. How do we make something become law?
Mm-hmm.
Because what he's doing is trying to utilize what should be a legal process, meaning creating a budget, and utilize it to strong arm legislative changes to the state and constitutional changes that really should go through the legislative process, meaning mm-hmm. bill making.
Mm-hmm.
The very basic process as to why we all elected is to write laws and to improve society. But he doesn't want to use that process. It doesn't mm-hmm. work. It's not convenient.
And to debate those laws, I mean, there's something to be said about that process. It's not a monarchy where you have mm-hmm. you know, a king who just decides what his dictates are going to be to the public. You are all elected to go represent your constituency. And you made a point earlier, you know, that how is it possible? And I got to tell you, I served with a lot of really great people on the other side of the aisle, right? And it's disheartening for me as a Democrat who did serve in, I would say, a very bipartisan way when I served there for 10 years, to see that there's not a single Republican who's cast a vote to protect child care in the state of Illinois, or Meals on Wheels, or the developmentally disabled. I mean, how is that possible? How is that possible? And if we do not stand up for the most vulnerable in this state, then what does that say about us? Forget about electeds and beings.
Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning. It's Aaron again. I just wanted to call and say that...
Good morning.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Good morning.
All right, how are you, Ms. Mendoza?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing great. I just wanted to say that in our meeting yesterday is an executive board, and we'll be voted on this morning by SEIU Local 73. We did indeed vote to endorse you, Ms. Mendoza, for comptroller.
Woohoo!
So we're happy.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That.
Thank you very much.
And so I wanted to just go back to what it is that you're going to bring to this office that's different now. Certainly it resonates with me to think that that the current comptroller would be proud of being the wingman, so to speak, of as my wife calls him, a tyrannical governor who thinks he's king of Illinois. Mm-hmm. What is it that you really want to work on in that office that would be different than what's happening now?
Well, like thank I said, you. I think that the office, thank you for your question, first of all, it's instrumental in terms of people understanding that what does the comptroller even do, right? I mean, we pay the state's bills. And right now, when you tell people that, they laugh and they say, well, there's no
money.
You're
not paying
right?
the state's bills.
And we're not paying the state's bills. But there certainly is money. And I think in while there's not enough, and I think that that's an argument that needs to be made as well when we're talking about budgets, but the reality of it is that you have a responsibility to prioritize payments. And how you go about prioritizing those payments is important, and it says a lot about who we want to be as a state and as a people. Certainly, I think developmentally disabled folks, early intervention specialists, those should be prioritized payments. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to working with groups, for example, SEIU in particular, that, you know, they've got three different branches, but many home health care workers, for example, folks who go ahead and provide early intervention services have to be paid. If they don't get paid, then they stop providing those services because they themselves have to eat, have to provide for their families. Right. And if they're not getting paid, they go under. So I have almost a three-year-old son. I also have an 80-year-old mother. Mm. I'm in what people know as the sandwich generation. As a matter of fact, today my husband is not on this, nor is my son on this tour of Central Illinois and Champaign-Urbana area because he's moving my mother into our home.
Mm.
Because we have to think about her future, and she's one fall away from really being in a situation where we have to make, you know, medical decisions for her, and she loses that control. And so I'm very cognizant that my mom's not getting any younger, and we'd rather think about taking care of her now, bringing her into our home where she's still healthy, can spend time with our son. But at the same time, I'm thinking about her future, and there's lots of families that fall into that exact same definition. So I know firsthand what it is to struggle with an incredibly intelligent little boy who hasn't figured out whether he wants to speak English or Spanish. I only speak to him in Spanish at home. My husband speaks to him in English. He's hearing it from both, and he's probably a little confused. And he's very, very smart, but his speech isn't where I'd like it to be. And 3 weeks ago, we were talking to a speech therapist who told us that, unfortunately, she had to stop providing therapy because her organization that she worked for wasn't getting paid. And while we can afford to pay for it out of pocket, and we've been from the beginning, most people can't. And that's so right. Our son can go on and continue therapies that are privately funded. But why is that fair for my son and someone else, another mother who loves their child just as much, whose child needs early intervention services, is going to have to go without? It is wrong on so many levels. And as a state, we should, at the very, very least, look out for those who are part of that safety net. Right now, the governor's got a huge hole in that safety net. And instead of having a comptroller who screams and yells at the top of her lungs and tries to use her bully pulpit, frankly, to bully back, is saying that she's proud to be his wingman. So you're not going to get that from me. Like I said, I may be short, but I'm going to stand tall for people in this state, and I'm going to make sure that everyone who stands on the side of, you know, lowering wages for families across the state of Illinois, of trying to decimate the middle class, is going to know that there's someone that's going to look out for them and stand up and voice the concern. Be a truth teller as to what is actually happening in the state of Illinois, and not wait for the governor to tell me who I should pay and when, but actually serve as a checks and balance to the governor and a vocal checks and balance to that office. That's what this office needs. I certainly have a track record as city clerk of knowing how to modernize an office. When I first ran the Civic Federation, which tends to lean Republican, it's made up of a lot of business people, they said that we should eliminate this clerk's office. It should be an appointed position, that whatever we do could be done better by the mayor's office. And 4.5 years later, after I pulled off the greatest technology modernization of that office, are producing revenues for the city at the tune of $5 million a year in stable recurring revenues without asking people, taxpayers, to pay more. I've eliminated the lines at our office very much the way Secretary White did. And guess what? Civic Federation asked me to give their big address about 3 weeks ago at their annual banquet. So now they're saying, and people are looking at our office and saying, what's the city clerk doing in the city of Chicago? And people should be seeing and talking about that innovation, because that's what we need in other areas. So I've got that experience. I have 10 years under my belt as a legislator. I've got those relationships. But more than anything, I have the tenacity, the drive, and the determination to be a voice of advocacy for people in this state and to be a truth teller in terms of being a comptroller who says it like it is, who walks it like talks it, and who wants to get things done.
And that's a huge position. What we see happening now, as you said, the comptroller who's okay with not paying the bills and saying, oh, well, just can't pay them because we don't have any money, or you got to sue us first, and then we'll pay. I think what we've seen happening is that people are saying, wait a minute, money is still coming state. Why is it then in the comptroller's office that she's refusing to pay bills that really just should be paid under the regular process?
Right. And if you feel that something's more important than those absolute safety net issues that you have to be taken to court to pay, then why don't you tell us what they are? I'm really curious to see what vendors she believes are more important to pay that are not court mandated payments than, you know, children who need services or seniors who are on their deathbed.
So we've not been able to get, as a legislature, we've not been able to get a clear picture from the comptroller's office what money is being paid out, which is allocated through court orders, and what money is available for us to, even if we thought we could come up with some budget, how much money do we have to work with?
Right.
What's going on? Are we beyond? This is the interesting thing when I talk about this to people on either side, doesn't matter. Most people don't understand that the budget that was put forward by the Democratic leadership and the Democratic members of the House, which was $36 billion, that we may have already exceeded spending $36 billion through court orders, legal fees, and all of this ridiculous process that's taking place as a result of the governor's veto of all of our budget bills besides education. So what happens in the comptroller's office? Where's the information?
Well, first of all, it shouldn't be kept secret from the public, because this is not her money. It's not the governor's money. It's the people's money. It's called taxpayer dollars. And there should be open and transparent accessibility for the public. So, and especially, let's just be brutally honest, especially the lawmakers who are having to determine what the priorities of the state are going to be. So the fact of the matter is, you've had legislators who've had to call hearings that the comptroller doesn't even show up to, asking for an explanation of who's getting paid, why, and how. And it shouldn't have to come to that point, but certainly, at the very least, she should show up, right? Not send a surrogate who doesn't know how to answer any questions.
And won't.
And won't, of course. Mm-hmm. Probably does know, but won't. More importantly. Yeah. And so there's this total veil of secrecy about this money, which is, again, the people's money. And we are in a situation where we have a comptroller, but it's really Bruce Rauner.
And he's also so he's playing multiple roles right now. He's mm-hmm. running the hat of the governor. He's running the hat of the Republican legislators. He's also wearing the hat of the comptroller, and he's playing all the strings at one time and not allowing anyone to see really what's going on. We had a hearing in last week when we were in Springfield. I'm not on that committee, but I served it as a sub. And we were trying to understand why the state superintendent of education was giving this huge parachute deal to be the superintendent of the schools for the state of Illinois. And the benefit package alone was the total budget of the SIDS program for Illinois, Sudden Infant Death Syndrome. Their program, again, will close because they didn't receive their budgetary allocation from the state, which was only about $225,000. And we gave that to one person to be superintendent of schools, of which we haven't been able to figure out why you have a superintendent of education and a education czar, which we have no idea what either one of them does. Mm-hmm. And as we try to investigate this through the committee process and to make it public, they won't show up. Mm-hmm. Not one of them came.
People
need to know this.
It's disgusting is what it is.
So we are trying to put in place a comptroller who will open up transparency in the state of Illinois, who will challenge decision making. What are we spending and why are we spending it? Maybe investigate, should we be spending it?
That's exactly
who are these
right.
people that's getting this money?
That's what I'd like to know. And I think taxpayers deserve a right to know who's getting paid and why and how, because the prioritization that comptroller has, that power of prioritizing payments, is really important. And to think that right now no payment gets done unless if the governor approves it, because that's how it's playing out. And, you know, on the last couple of days, you've seen some action from the comptroller. I think she's seen that her polling is probably not as good as they'd like it to be these days, and is now trying to distance herself a little bit, right, from the governor, saying, oh, you should play a little bit nicer with labor groups, or, you know, don't beat them up so much. But she's not out there saying, you know, this is wrong, what you are doing. She's still saying, the Democrats should be working a little bit more with Governor Rauner. You guys need to figure it out. No. Let me just remind people that while Illinois has never always been on this like amazing financial footing, we have never gone this long without a balanced budget. We have never actually been inflicting this kind of pain on anyone the way we're seeing it play out right now. And the only new variable in this equation is Bruce Rauner. That's it. I understand that there's always, you know, elections are always partisan and these things happen. But, you know, in the 10 years that I was there, we never didn't have a budget in October going into November. In this case, who knows if we'll have one next year. And that the only time that has happened is under this leadership. It didn't happen under Jim Edgar. It didn't happen under George Ryan. It didn't happen under Jim Thompson. It's only happening under Bruce Rauner. And so you look at how many years of state, you know, governing have been before us, you know, Carol, and the first time that we've been in this type of a crisis, you know, I'm not going to blame it on anyone other than the new variable in the equation, and that's really Bruce Rauner. He controls it. He should have presented his budget that balanced. He should have signed the budget, and he shouldn't be holding the budget hostage, which isn't a budget that he's holding hostage. It's people. It is people that are hurting every single day, but he doesn't see it because he's never felt it. And if you've never felt it, you just can't, frankly, understand it. And it really is. I agree with the fact that people need to figure out a way how we rise up. And it's not even about convincing this governor, because he's beyond convincing. He doesn't care. It's about convincing the other members who took an oath to serve the public that they should care about Meals on Wheels. They should care about children who need help. And they should care about our elderly seniors. The governor's never going to see dying seniors as profitable. So as far as he's concerned, we might as well not have them, right?
Unless they're in his for-profit nursing homes. Well, let me just tell you that you're listening to 90.1 FM WEFT, and someone is trying to call me in studio, But they're calling the non-studio line. Please call 217-359-5483. That's 217-359-5483. I'd love to put you on. Unfortunately for you, you have to fly live if you want to talk to me, because there's no one else that will take your call on the outside of the studio. So you can call me, 359-5483. I am in, and this is Sister Carol on Higher Ground this morning with Susana Mendoza, former state legislator, current city clerk of Chicago, and candidate for comptroller for the state of Illinois. And we're talking about this because people need to see the connections between the offices and what they are supposed to do for the people of Illinois. I want you to know that this program is being sponsored by Kevin Elliott Counseling. I mentioned Kevin Elliott Counseling earlier, and I do want to say it again because I know people are struggling. And if you really need someone to talk to, I want you to call Kevin Elliott Counseling at 217-398-9066. That's 217-398-9066. Please don't stay alone. Share your concerns. Help, get help for your problems that you're experiencing, stress, marital counseling needed, group, family, individual, children's. Whatever the issue is, please call Kevin Elliott Counseling at 217-398-9066. We appreciate Kevin Elliott and all the work that he does in this community and his full-fledged 30 staff members who try to help you. Please call them. Again, you're listening to WFT 90.1 FM, and this is Higher Ground. You can call us 359-5483. And in studio with me is Susana Mendoza, who's a comptroller candidate for the state of Illinois. Now, I seem to understand that there is a constitutional responsibility in the comptroller's office. Can you explain what that responsibility is? What are you supposed to do?
Well, we have we are the official. We pay the bills, right? Mm-hmm. That's our authority. But we also have independent constitutional authority to do things, for example, which makes this very interesting at this time, given the assault on labor, right? The comptroller has the authority to also exercise executive authority. Back in the day, you may recall, and some listeners might, that we used to have, there was a moment where we had a Republican governor and a Republican attorney general, and we also had a Democratic comptroller that was Comptroller Dan Hines.
Oh,
and there was a major attack on labor, and nothing like today. But at that time, there were projects that were state funded that were not paying prevailing wage. Okay, which is a big, huge issue. And basically the governor was turning a blind eye to it, and the attorney general at the time really wasn't enforcing the prevailing wage mandates. So Comptroller Hines did what no one ever really kind of seen done before. And that was he put out an executive order that said that if you don't pay prevailing wage, which is the law, I'm not going to pay you. I have that authority as, you know, the comptroller, executive officer. So that was really like one of those instances where people had maybe never heard of the comptroller's office. And then all of a sudden everyone knew about the comptroller's office because they realized that you're independently elected by the people. And as such, you have certain authorities that are given to you that you're allowed to exercise, and not often do you have to. And then, you know, that you can imagine people started paying prevailing wage very quickly.
Oh.
Just coincidental, right? But it just goes to show. And then after that came a Democratic governor and a Democratic attorney general. So no longer was this an issue because obviously they were paying prevailing wage. And, you know, we didn't need the comptroller to come out and really kind of play hardball like that. But that's a perfect example of having this constitutional authority and being able to exercise it when it's appropriate.
Because the comptroller doesn't work for the governor, right?
He or she does not work for the governor.
The comptroller doesn't work for the governor.
That's exactly right.
And it seems that what we've seen is that all of a sudden the comptroller seems to work for the governor as opposed to being an independently
that's
elected,
exactly right,
responsive to the people of Illinois office. And I think that's something that has really certainly shaken up our agencies who, like the agency before you, Esau Griffith's agency, she's executive director of, has $400,000 sitting in probably the comptroller's office, who could pay it, but is for whatever reason not prioritizing the payments to social service agencies right. that are providing services in community.
And also not saying anything to anyone, right? I mean, I hear this everywhere I go across the state that there's, I wouldn't say a response, it's just complete non-responsiveness. And if you're lucky enough to get a response, it's, we'll sue us. If a court tells me, then I'll do it. But, you know, there's no explanation as to when or how or if you can even ever expect payment. And there's this total lack of understanding or acceptance that it's not about paying that service provider manager. It's about who they represent and the people that are being hurt day in and day out because they're unable to get the services that they require, sometimes to survive. And I hate to say it, but I almost feel like people are going to have to start dying in order for legislators or this governor to get the hint. And maybe that's what he wants. I hope not, because how could anybody be that really kind of inhumane? But the situation is reaching a boiling point.
I'm going to read this text because it really fits to what you're saying that I just received. And it just says critical services are going away in a sad state of affairs. This governor said he was going to be the jobs governor, and they laugh, ha, ha, ha. I have never been on unemployment until now. He's putting people literally on the streets.
Yes.
Literally on the streets. People who have worked their entire life mm-hmm. are experiencing service providers, small business people, job training programs. We lost every single job training program that was run through the University of Illinois. All of those programs were cut out of the budget. Every last one of them. So we are literally at critical moments like, man, what is happening? Where are these people and what's happening to them? Is there a conversation going on? And I remember the comptroller saying, well, we are paying the bills that we have to pay. Mm-hmm. Which means that unless you sue us, unless you have revenue, unless you have an attorney that can really literally carry this through the court process, we're not going to pay you.
Like, you need a comptroller who's going to tell this governor as loud as she possibly can, stop holding the budget hostage to your other non-budgetary demands. It's that simple. We have a process. If your ideas are so great, let's put them up for a vote independently of the budget, and let's see where that goes. But he knows that there's no chance that in the state of Illinois, we're going to vote to decimate hardworking men and women in this state. He knows that his ideas are completely radical, and they hurt working men and women. They hurt mothers, they hurt children, they hurt elderly. And none of those ideas in and of themselves are going to fly at all. And so the only thing he can do is try to inflict so much pain that people start screaming uncle. But people have to realize that he may be talking about jobs day and night, but here's what's going to happen. If you did actually get rid of labor, when I talked about driving down wages, instead of 20 jobs at, let's say, $20 an hour, you're going to create 40 jobs. But guess what? At $10 an hour, right? So are we better off? No, we're not. His buddies are better off.
Yes.
They've got more people working for them, but a lot lower wages. And that doesn't help anybody in this state.
Well, we hope that...
it helps some people, but not the ones that...
I would say, because some people are really...
It helps those that would like to be paying less wages and have more employees doing their work.
We hear every week, that every month now, I would love to go every week, because I think we should just keep it in the press and in the media. But nonetheless, each time we're in session, I hear a almost incoherent argument from the other side of the aisle suggesting that any of this makes sense. Well, we are trying to be responsible for the taxpayers' dollar.
They're afraid of getting a candidate put against them at $1 million a pop. That's what they're afraid of. And they've been told that that's what's going to happen. And so, unfortunately, I think people are scared about that. And they're willing to vote against Meals on Wheels or funding, like I said, the most developmentally disabled needy people in the world, or in Illinois at least, because they're more concerned about their next election cycle. And that is a travesty, shameful, it's wrong. And it really bothers me because I certainly know, and I served with a lot of those people, and I think, how is this possibly happening? I got to believe that none of them can be happy with these decisions that they're making right now. And so, you know, to actually get up and talk and try to make a coherent or a cogent argument about something that really is not anything that I would ever be saying that would make me proud to say is a little bit disheartening. But I got to believe I'm still an eternal optimist that, you know, people are going to figure this out. The media will hopefully start saying the truth about what is happening and acknowledge that the only new variable in this equation that is inflicting lots of pain is the new governor that we have. And unfortunately, the comptroller's office belongs to him right now.
Well, we hope to regain the comptroller's office with your election. And if come next November, you are our comptroller, I know he's going to be like, whoa, wait a minute. You can't elect Susana Mendoza. This is problematic. So I'm sure he's saying, oh, we better start investing into this other lady over here. What are you hearing on the ground about the comptroller's race and what's going to happen?
Well, ultimately? What I hear is, of course, that, yeah, she's going to have, you know,
his blessings.
Financial blessing. Yes. And she's not really out there pushing hard to raise money right now, which is an indicator that she's been told, don't worry about it, we'll take care of you. And I would have every expectation to be outspent 2-3, 4-1. But, you know, people, I believe I'm on the right side of this fight. I believe that people understand what's going on. They're not as dumb as the governor would like them to think. And I hope that people have learned their lesson from what happened in this last election, and that in this particular election, they send a message that we do need an independent voice of advocacy for people, not for him. He can hire enough of those, but for people who don't have necessarily that voice or the ability to get it out as loudly, who don't have a statewide elected position that they can actually advocate from. So I'm looking forward to doing that. And I'm also looking forward to working with colleagues on both sides of the aisle. That's what I was like when I was elected as a state rep, and I was very effective as a legislator. And I'm not here to really like beat up on everybody who's on the other in the other party. There's a lot of good people there. Carol, you serve with them, and you know that I'm.
And that's
truthful.
Why I'm so surprised.
I know,
I'm like,
me too.
Oh my God, I know you care about these people.
Me too. I really believe that, and that's why, you know, I just think it. You know, hopefully, folks know on that side of the aisle that they know me. They know that I'm a good person, and they know that I clearly do like to collaborate and build consensus. But right now, at this time in this race, we need somebody who really is going to go in there and push back and say, I'm going to fight for people. If you don't really care about that little kid or that senior who's on their deathbed, I do. And every day that I wake up in my house, I see my son who represents everybody else's kid out there. And I also see my mom. And Carol, you just lost your mom, and I'm so sorry about that. But you know what I'm talking about.
My mother wrote about this governor, and really? I'm going to share it at some point on the floor.
And I just feel like we've got to do something for the people of Illinois, and I'm very excited and honored to have received endorsements across the state. I mean, Aaron talked about my endorsement with SEIU. I was endorsed by all three of the branches of SEIU, the locals, as well as the AFL-CIO, which represents hardworking men and women, certainly in the trades across the state of Illinois, and also by the Southern 20, you know, the Democratic committeemen of the Southern 20, the southernmost 20 counties in the state of Illinois, which is interesting because, of course, I am from Chicago, right? But I grew up in, I was born in Chicago, and I spent part of my life second through sixth grade in DuPage County, and then also went to high school and junior high in Bolingbrook, which is Will County. And my mom right now lives in Crest Hill, but will soon be moving in with us, as I mentioned. And so, you know, I've got connections in many different parts of the state. My brother was a police officer before coming to Chicago for 10 years in the Quad Cities in Moline, and I've been out there quite a bit since I decided to make this run. And so I love the state of Illinois. And it's funny because I might be the only Chicago Democrat in history to have actually received the Pork Producer Legislator of the Year Award, right?
Okay.
So that usually goes to downstaters.
So I'll let you have that one.
Downstaters, yeah, it's not yours. And I also got like the Friend of Agriculture Award from the Bureau of Farm County when I was in legislature, yeah, right? So I was an adopted legislator. And I got to know my colleagues on both sides of the aisle because I think it's important in being an effective leader. And unfortunately, you've just seen over the years, things have gotten so much more rancorous and contentious and cantankerous, I should say. And I feel that you have to do that at times, but I'm going to go there and beat up a process that is hurting people and beat up whoever is supporting the process, but at the same time, extend my hand in collaboration and cooperation with anyone who wants to actually solve the problems of the state. I think there's a lot of people who, unfortunately, right now are scared about, you know, standing up to this guy, but, you know, I've never been one to back down.
I believe wholeheartedly in the principle of justice, and I believe in the principle of justice as an activity of fair dealing. And so it's not a party issue. it really is an activity of fair dealing. And what we are experiencing is less than justice, meaning the people are not receiving adequate representation in the state legislature and in the governor's office when people don't see this as an activity of fair dealing. Mm-hmm. So am I opposed to entering into a legislative discussion about further reforms to workers' compensation that may be beneficial to small business retainment? I'm not opposed to that. What I am opposed to is using that thing to hold up the payment of every single issue in the state of Illinois, including last week, the Fire Safety Institute. We won't pay for fire safety education for our firemen. This is beyond anything that any of us expected.
That's right.
So we're not talking strictly about partisan, although it has become so partisan.
It's become that.
It's become more partisan than maybe it had been before. Mm-hmm. And some argue saying, oh, the Democrats were always doing this. Well, maybe so. It was partisan then, but it has become extraordinarily partisan in a way that we're not funding Department of Natural Resources in the state of Illinois.
Right.
Things that would normally be funded by bipartisan
support.
By both
parties,
right?
Exactly. By both parties.
So what we're saying, you know, we're not going to pay lottery winnings. I mean, that's beyond anything I can comprehend. But again, this is a activity of fair dealing, which is what produces justice. And when you don't have activities of fair dealing, you have despair and hopelessness. And he's creating a crisis and a recession in the state of Illinois that makes us the laughingstock of the entire nation. And so I believe that we need to get back to the business of justice and fair dealing. And I hope that as you continue to stump throughout the state, that you can clarify the importance of having a comptroller who will say, my responsibility to you, not my responsibility to him, but my responsibility to you is to make sure that the state is not habitually late making its payments, mm-hmm. as it had been in many, many generations before me and you mm-hmm. probably were mm-hmm. born. But habitually, we want to end that practice. We want to pay our bills because that's how we expect everybody else to live, right?
Sure.
We want to be responsive to the people and the needs and priorities of the state, not necessarily to the political practices of another person's office. Mm-hmm. And that is what we're experiencing now. And I hope that you're successful in carrying that message forward as you travel throughout the state.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I really appreciate your support. It means a lot to me, and I've gotten a great deal of support from my colleagues in the House that I serve with and many new ones like yourself that I didn't get an opportunity to, but you've heard good things, hopefully.
Yes.
And yeah, this is going to not be an easy battle, and we need people. As I travel the state, I have so many people that I meet, and they tell me, well, good luck to you. We're excited. Good luck. And I said, well, thank you for the well wishes, but can I count on your vote?
Because that's what matters.
Luck is nice, but votes are better. So please, you know, we need to really kind of coalesce and get excited about doing what's right for people in this state. And in order for me to be able to be that voice of advocacy in a way that's effective means I need to get there. And so that means I need to respectfully and humbly ask your audience to please give me a chance to go out there for you. But more so than just well wishes and good luck wishes, I need your votes. Not once,
how do they
but
get
twice,
how
and
because
I'm from Chicago, right?
Let's talk about that.
There's a primary and a general.
So how do they get information about you? Where is it?
So I have a website. It's www.SusannaMendoza.com.
You might have to slow that down. I know the Latina
in
you is going fast.
Auctioneer or something, right? Yeah, I'm used to reading everything fast okay. in the city council. It's at SusannaMendoza.com. And my first name, Susanna, is actually spelled like Susan, but with an A at the end. So just SusannaMendoza. And then MENDOZA.com. And I'm also, you can follow me on Facebook or Twitter, SusannaMendoza.com. It's pretty easy.
Susanna. I like Susanna. I like Susanna. To say the word Susanna. It's a nice name.
Well, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you coming down and you're going to hang out with us. So tell us what the rest of your weekend will look like.
I've got a pretty exciting weekend. I'm going to a couple of tailgate parties.
Ooh, tailgates.
And let's see, what are we doing, Carol? All right. I've got the farmer's market I'm going to go hit. So
which
if you
is
see
great.
Me there, say hello. Give me a hug. Please, I'm a hugger. Then we're going to the Black Alumni Network tailgating.
I may need a ride because parking on campus is going to be
I got notorious. You, don't worry. Yeah, and then homecoming tailgating party at Memorial Stadium. And then we're also going to, I'm going to head out to Richland County later tonight for a meet and greet out there. And then after that, I'm going to the Franklin County JFK dinner.
Okay.
So I'll be traveling to Franklin County and then coming back. And then the next day, you and I are going to be good Christians and head out to church.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the evening, I'm going to the Democrats' fall dinner.
Which should be interesting.
Here in Champaign, yeah. So I'm very excited about it. And then eventually going home to see my baby when he's sleeping, smell him, because I love to do that, and every mom will know what I'm talking about, and give him lots of kisses while he's asleep, and then wake up to see him in the morning. So it's
well,
the best
we
part of being a mom.
Know that this is a very big order that you've taken on.
Yes.
We don't only wish you the best, but we'll be out there supporting and stumping in the months coming here.
Thank you.
And really raise the level of importance of the comptroller's office in a way that didn't exist before. People, although the comptroller was always on that ballot, people may have just overlooked that position. Now, we know this very famous person held it for a long time, and her passing last year, I believe it was, opened this up.
Yeah.
And so...
But you know what's interesting? Had she not passed away, she wouldn't be sitting idly right now. She'd be taking this governor in a big way. And I know that for a fact. I believe it in the bottom of my heart.
I think you're
and
absolutely correct.
Even though
correct.
She was a Republican, she'd have been like, are you kidding me? You should be ashamed of yourself. And it is a real shame that she's not here. And I have to be honest with you. I'm sorry that I even have to be running for this position, because if she were here, this wouldn't be happening. Or at least if it was happening,
she would have responded.
She'd be taking it to
she
him right
She would have responded.
Now.
I believe
right.
you're telling the truth. Barbara Frasca was known for, I mean, not Barbara
Judy
Frasca, Judy Bart. I'm
yeah.
thinking about her former.
Yeah.
But Judy Bartopinka would have responded. And the last time I saw her, not shockingly, we got a call about this morning at SEIU. I was at SEIU 73's meeting in Chicago when I first ran. And she and I were on the program together.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first time meeting her in person.
And you'll never forget. She's
and,
a dynamo,
and she
yeah.
She came very straight and direct.
Big time.
And unfortunately, she left us a little bit after that, maybe a month or so after that. But it was really a pleasure to be able to see her, and you hear about her, and you're speaking in other places. But I believe, as you believe, that if she were here, she would not sit by and let
no.
do what he's doing. This is so important for people. So you all who are listening, the comptroller's office may have been something of an obscure office, except that you wanted the check coming from that
right.
office. But in this case, this office is so critical and is becoming more and more important to the state of Illinois than what it may have been in the past. But when you see the name on the ballot this time, you will know what the comptroller's responsibility is, and you will vote, certainly vote your conscience, but we want you to vote in your best interest.
Yes.
And so
hopefully
we appreciate
your conscience
that.
Is telling you, Susana Mendoza, Susana Mendoza, vote for Susana Mendoza.
We definitely want that conscience to be responding in that way, and you'll continue to stump. So I
for
hope
sure.
this is not your last visit to Champaign
oh, no
County
way, no way.
During this whole process.
No way.
We'll
you'll
be happy
me.
To have you here. We host lots and lots of events, so there's always a way
That's
to plug
great.
In. And so I appreciate you spending this morning with us. And for those who are listening, we will, I'll just make my own shameless plug, since this is my own radio program, even if Aaron thinks it's just his. But... on November 7th, I will make my own reelection announcement here
Yay.
In Champaign-Urbana for a program we are calling Women Making Waves. And Susana is definitely a woman making waves here in the state of Illinois. We are going to have none other than the former senator and first U.S. African-American woman senator from the state of Illinois here in Champaign-Urbana. Carol Mulvey Braun will be joining us as our special guest, along with hopefully Karen Yarbrough also
oh,
be
she's
here,
awesome too. Yeah.
Of whom I really love too. And so we're just trying to highlight the power of these women in the state of Illinois and what contributions they've given locally. We have our former state representative Naomi Jacobson, who's going to come with us for our breakfast. We're going to have a great time
she's
that
wonderful.
Morning. So if you're interested in joining us for our Women Making Waves event November 7th, you're welcome You're welcome to call or go to my website, which is CarolAmmons4StateRep.com.
And make sure to spread the word about my girl, Carol Ammons, because we need to get her reelected.
ForStateRep.com, CarolAmmons4StateRep.com, or you can call me. I have a cell phone that belongs to my campaign that I sometimes answers, but you can definitely call me at 255-3754. That's 217-255-3754. And that's Carol Ammons for staterep.com. The word for, F-O-R, staterep.com. You can get information about our announcement, November 7th, Women Making Waves Brunch. It will be at the Hawthorne Suites in the city of Champaign on November 7th from 10 to 12. So we want you to join us. Call me. Don't let anything keep you from coming that morning. So call me. If you want to be there, we will make it happen. 217-3, I'm sorry, not the station. Call my office, 217-255-3754. That's how you get a hold of me. And I am so honored. I got a few more minutes before our next show comes on, News from Neptune. We want to hear from Paul Muth in the next hour, which I know is going to be inspiring and educational. So we want to do that. As I close in the next minutes, I do want to share some of my own thoughts. I was able to travel to Washington, D.C. just after my mother's passing. I was actually supposed to go there October 1st. And I was going to a White House briefing, which was only hosting 200 legislators from around the country. So I was one of those legislators that was chosen to do this White House briefing, which I was so honored.
Women making waves.
Yes. So I was honored by that, but I did not get an opportunity to go to the October 1st White House briefing, unfortunately, because of the passing of my mother. But my mother made this pillow, and she used to do crafts. So she made this pillow, and there's a picture of me and my husband on one of the pillows, and then my children on other pillows. And on my pillow, she wrote politician. She writes it at the bottom, politician. And she did this a long time ago. So it's a picture of me when I was in my early 20s. And it's politician at the bottom. Mrs. President 2020. So she made this pillow like maybe 20 years ago. That tells me how old I am now. So I was old enough for that pillow, but she made that pillow. And right before she left, she and I talked about going to the White House briefing. Mm-hmm. So she was so excited about me going to the White House briefing. So she said, take a lot of pictures, make a book for me so I can make it into your album that she was collecting for me. And I missed that, but I was able to go on the 5th of October and decided to go on there for a very important process. So I joined a group of other people from around the country at the Capitol for not only a Capitol visit and briefing around some legislative issues, but I also got a chance to go to the WAN conference, the Women Action Network. That WAN changed their name. Let me see. No, Women for a New Direction. That's what WAN stands for. And these are legislators from across the country who are looking at peace legislation. So not only on the national level, but on the state level. So I went to that conference, and I also got a chance to meet Department of Agriculture, which is important for our state. As well as to testify at the Federal Communications Commission hearing that was being organized by community groups from around the country to address the prison phone justice issue in the state of Illinois. And so I testified with a senator I brought along with me. I kind of recruited somebody there from Wisconsin to address the issue of prison phone justice, led by Danielle Chenoweth and the Center for Media Democracy, Center for Media Justice out of Oakland, California. And what we learned, and this is something that I hope that as comptroller you will look into, because I intend to work on it legislatively. In the state of Illinois, the prison phone companies pay a commission back to the state of Illinois for no reason whatsoever, except that it just allows them to maintain a contract with the state of Illinois for the state prisons. And as a result of that, they give back to the state of Illinois about just under $14 million each year to hold that contract. Mm-hmm. And so it goes into, I can't necessarily track down where the money, how it's spent in the state of Illinois, but because of the controller issue, we've not been able to make clearly where this money's going. But the people who are being hurt by that are the poor families of those people who are incarcerated. And so they can't talk to their loved ones because the cost of a 15-minute phone call that may cost you and I about a cent cost them, it was costing them as of Thursday, it was costing them upwards of about $15, $16, $20, depends on where you call from. If it's Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, the cost of a 15-minute phone call could darn near cost you $30 just to make a 15-minute phone call from a state prison in the state for which they're calling. So this has been a long-term normal practice in an exploitative kind of industry. And so what happened on this Thursday is the Federal Communications Commission ruled that they would cap the rate. So capping the rate may have taken that phone call from $15 down to $1.96 for a 15-minute phone call, which is huge. This is a change of historic proportions in the country. Now, we know that the Federal Communications Commission's ruling is going to be challenged by the phone companies,
of course,
because they're ones like make the billionaires, right? So that's where, when we think about Bruce Rauner, we have to search, where did he get this money from and how is he a billionaire? Because it will tell you how much of your money is going into the pockets of billionaires who are using that money to buy elections and to keep good people out of elections, like Susana Mendoza. They're going to dump money into this race, but Susana says, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to fight them back. And so in this case, we have to cut off this kind of exploitative system and end practice. And so my goal is to introduce legislation in the spring to eliminate the kickback to the state of Illinois on the backs of poor and minority people, primarily black and brown, in the state prisons throughout our state are experiencing this, but poor whites are also experiencing it, and we need to stop the practice. And so the FCC has taken a large leap forward and capped the rate. I believe they capped it at about 11 cents, which is still beyond what the state committee, I mean the national committee, wanted. But that changes the game significantly for families and communication.
You're probably going to see a whole bunch of states do that.
So the goal really is for us to get this practice ended. And I'll be working on that coming the spring. We're drafting legislation for it. And for our state, we have support from all over the country to make this happen. And we want to know, where is this money and where is it going and who's getting it? And that's what we've not been able to narrow down through the comptroller's records at this point. But we need a comptroller who...